Nice to be back. I arrived back about... Let me see. I think it was about 5:30 or 6 o'clock this morning, London time. I finally got to bed about midnight our time, after quite a long flight from London. So I think, first of all, perhaps you'd like to hear a little about the trip. I was a little impressed by one thing said by Mr. McNair in the opening prayer about how this land has been blessed above all lands. Now, on this trip, I spent a few days in Jerusalem. Jerusalem had been called the glory of all lands. But do you know that our United States of America in our lifetime has been blessed above the land of Israel and above Jerusalem? And right now that is the troubled spot of the world, and is going to be the troubled spot of the world until Christ comes to put the fire out. I just had to recall that this country has been blessed above every other country in the world. And I wonder if you know why. Now, this afternoon, I have no prepared sermon at all. I just arrived back late last night. As I say, we've been, you might say, traveling all night on the plane because it was about 5 or 6, 5:30 or 6 or something like that in the morning when we arrived here. By London time, by the time we've been on for several days, and even later than that, a few days before when we came from Cairo and Jerusalem, and of course, a trip like that is a very tiresome trip. You have to get over a jet lag, because you arrive here after you've been up all night, and then it's just time to go to bed and sleep another night. Going the other way, you get it just the opposite. We left here, I believe it was about noon, and inside of about a couple of hours, the sun had set and it was dark, because the sun was traveling this way and we were going the other way. We were going about as fast toward the east as the sun seemed to be going toward the west. And then we were all night on the plane arriving. I think we arrived at this time about 4 o'clock in the morning in London, London time. Or not London, we landed actually out at Luton, quite a ways north of London. But we prefer to land out at that airport. It's so much easier to get through customs, immigration, and everything out there. And then my car can drive out and right to the airplane there. And, of course, that can't happen if we go into London. It's the Heathrow Airport. They have to send a bus out for us, and we go through a lot of regulations to get through immigration and then customs before you get in. And then it still is almost as long to get into London because there's heavier traffic as it is on the motorway, as they call it over there. We call it freeways here into London from out in Luton, which is the other side of Brick and Wood by some little distance. Anyway, I think I'll tell you first about the trip. And then I wanted to get back to some other things that I think we need right now. This world is in a very upset and disturbed condition. You stay here in this beautiful city, and we talk as if it's a terrible thing to have some rain out there. It's a great blessing. The sun is still shining, you know. It's just filtered sunshine. The sun is still shining up above those clouds, just the same as always. And it's a great blessing to have that rain. If there were any forest fires, that'll help put them out. The people up in Oregon really rejoice when they get a little bit of rain. Let me see, someone in the morning service talked about that. Seemed like Oregon again. Someone who had been up there. Up there, they just enjoy the rain. Which all reminds me of how we're inclined to be like the ancient Israelites. They were grumbling and complaining. The Bible calls it murmuring all the time. They had to criticize, find fault. Everything was wrong. They were discontented. You know, we're their great-great-great-great-grandchildren, and we seem to still be the same way. We don't appreciate the things we have, but we grumble about even the good things we have. We find fault. And I notice how we disobey another thing in the Scripture. It says we should rejoice in good things and believe the best instead of the worst. But we seem to want to believe the worst. If there's some bad news or someone does something wrong, the rumors will fly all over the United States about it. If something really good happens, it's never mentioned. When I said something about female makeup, and I just happened to think of it right in the middle of the sermon, and I let it go. On the Sabbath during the Feast of Tabernacles, when I was speaking over at Big Sandy. By the next day, what I said was known all over the United States. Women who didn't like what I said saw to it. They got on the telephone. They spent their money for long-distance telephone calls to get the news out to others, the bad news. Good news, we never gossip about. Did you ever think of that? Rumors are always bad news. Shame on us! What's the matter with us, brethren? Jesus Christ has been trying to clean up this church the last 3 years through me. And that's one thing that needs to be cleaned up. And all you brethren need to clean up your minds. If there's some bad news, you've got to get on the telephone. You've got to spread it everywhere. We're just like the Israelites of old. We complain, we grumble. We want to talk about the bad news. We should rejoice in the good news. We want to spread rumors about something good instead of something bad about people. Well, to get back to our trip, we arrived in London it was a Thursday or Friday morning. Anyway, we had a meeting over there. Our minister from New Zealand, the head of our office there, and also Herr Schnee, the head of our office in Germany, came over to have reports and talks with me. I spoke to a united congregation in London of more than 1,000 people on the Sabbath. That was 2 weeks ago today, I believe. And then on Monday, we flew on. I stopped off to have a board meeting of the King Leopold III Foundation of Belgium, of which I happen to be a member, and had luncheon with King Leopold and his wife, Princess Lillian. The others in the plane went into Belgium. I think they had lunch into Brussels. They had lunch in Brussels, did a little shopping for lace or some things like that that some of the ladies in the party wanted to buy. If you're ever in Brussels, that's a place to find some of the most beautiful lakes. And then we were back at the plane about 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We flew on to Jerusalem that night. And beginning Tuesday morning, I had many things to do in Jerusalem. I believe it was that night they had a special performance for me at the ICCY building, which is a special three-story building that we are supporting. It's the International Cultural Center for Youth. We are in that organization bringing the young people, especially teenagers, of the Arabs and of the Israelis together. And they both performed for me again, as they did the year before and have done many times in previous years, especially when we've sent a lot of students over to work in the archaeological project over there. And I had a very nice meeting with President Navon on Friday. He had been on Tuesday in Cairo, where he had a meeting with the new president, Mubarak, and also, he had gone especially for a meeting, a sort of condolence meeting, with Mrs. Sadat, the widow of the very recently assassinated President Sadat. Now, a year ago, I had quite a meeting with President Sadat, and that was televised, and many of you have seen it. It was on the air here on our program and some of our other televised pictures. And anyway, he asked me, even though he had just returned from Jerusalem, I was going over, and he asked me to carry his best wishes to President Mubarak and also to Mrs. Sadat, both of whom I saw in Cairo. So we went on over to Cairo, and there I had a meeting on the first morning after our arrival with the new President Mubarak. I met with Dr. Haddam first. And Dr. Haddam is the third man in power in Egypt, only behind the president and the prime minister. And there used to be the president and the vice president, and there was no prime minister. I know the first time I met Dr. Haddam, he received a telegram during our conversation. He looked at it and he smiled. He said, "Well," he says, "I just had word I'm the prime minister." He said, "President Sadat," and this was a few years ago, he said, "President Sadat, according to this wire, just arrived in Syria. When he's out of this country, I'm the prime minister. When he returns, I won't be prime minister any longer." Because at that time, the president acted as president, prime minister, and everything. So they had a vice president. And when President Sadat was assassinated, about a month ago, I think, the vice president, Mubarak, took the office. They had a quick election, and I think he received about 99%+ of the vote, and he is the president for the time being. There's to be another election after a certain time, but I think that is one or two or more years off. Anyway, I had a nice talk with him. He was a little shy and bashful and appeared not to be too warm, but a little stiff at first. However, you'll see the whole conversation. Either a week from Sunday or 2 weeks from Sunday, it will be on the air here. going to make a whole television program out of that meeting. Our television crew was over there. And President Mubarak warmed up as we talked. He warmed up to me, became very, very friendly. And he assured me that he is going to continue on President Sadat's efforts at peace with Israel and through the United States and their peace project at Mount Sinai. And, of course, I've heard a lot of talk on other sides about it. I found that in Cairo, in top circles even, that there is some skepticism as to whether he will be able to really hold the country. I find now many different versions of what happened in the assassination of President Sadat. I'll come to a little more of that as I go along. But I've had a lot of first-hand information that you don't get in the newspapers. First from Dr. Hatem, who was just the vice president, Mubarak, as he was at the time, was standing or sitting, but they had risen to stand at the time because the airplanes were going over. The whole thing was planned in advance and very professionally timed. The shooting took place while the jet planes were going over, making a big roaring noise. And jet planes do. And they were flying low so the noise, and purposely so that the noise would be almost deafening. They were looking up. And I saw pictures over there that were not in the newspapers here. The president for that was looking up. And down below were the men coming and shooting. And I saw the pictures of the whole thing. And Vice President Mubarak was standing right next to him. He was grazed in one hand with a bullet, and that's all. And I didn't notice anything wrong. It must have been just a very slight thing, because I didn't even notice a bandage on his hand. And next to him was Dr. Hatem. And he escaped without any trouble. He's the one who yelled out immediately for the ambulance to get President Sadat to a hospital. So I had his version of it. And then later, the morning that we left, I had a very nice visit with Mrs. Sadat in the Giza Palace, where I in the same room exactly, where I met her husband, President Sadat, a year ago. Many of you have seen that interview or portions of it on our television program. Now, at that time, Mrs. Sadat had met me at the car, took me by the arm, escorted me in. President Sadat, well, I'll have to go back a little bit. I had been over in a building where President Sadat was giving a national telephone, television and radio address to the nation. There was an auditorium on the ground floor, an office building above, and I was up in an office, the top of the office building. At the end of the address, I came down, our party, and we were escorted to a car immediately behind President Sadat's car. In between his car and ours was an ambulance. Wherever President Sadat went, the ambulance went with him just behind his car. In it was a physician and a nurse with equipment and everything anticipating an assassination. And there was a siren car ahead and a motorcycle escort with sirens blasting out. And we were rushed through the streets from this place, this auditorium and office building, on over to the Giza Palace. President Sadat got out of the car first, rushed into the palace to meet a visiting delegation of American congressmen. And he had to see them first. Mrs. Sadat came out, took me by the arm, escorted me into the house and into a salon off of the entering grand lobby or hall or whatever you call it, and talked with us for quite a while, about, 15 minutes or so, until President Sadat came in. He got rid of the congressman as soon as he could to come in and talk to me. Then, of course, she very graciously retired. But I had become by that time well acquainted with her, and so I wanted to have a meeting with her this time. I sent her a telegram on the very day of the assassination, and I knew that she would remember me. Now, incidentally, I had talked to Dr. Hannum about one thing. I said, did not President Sadat have quite an armed escort there? How did it happen that those men were able to come right up? And I could see them just running up before the stand with their gun just ready to shoot. And he says, no, there was no armed guard. President Sadat said, just a military parade, all these, no one will be there except my own soldiers. They're my own sons. They all love me. I don't need an armed escort. But it was one of those sons who loved him who shot him. Or as a matter of fact, it was about three or four of them. I don't know which one shot him. It just shows you that in these days and ages, you can't trust your own son. You can ask any police chief and he'll tell you that the largest portion of murders occur in the home. Children shooting parents, parents shooting, brother shooting sister, husband or wife shooting each other. That's true in almost any big city in the United States. I think it's true in big cities in other countries as well. But I know it's notoriously true in this country, as any police chief will tell you. Anyway, President Sadat had no guard, no protection whatever. It shows you you can't trust anybody in this world. Well, I had a visit with Mrs. Sadat. I came to know her better than I ever had before. I spoke with her for about 45 minutes. And I had heard that she did not wish to discuss the assassination with anybody. It was such a terrible shock to her that she didn't want to discuss it. But to my surprise, she opened up and told me all the details of it. She was in the stand with two of her grandchildren. And one of her grandchildren, a little boy, a year and a half old, was brought in by a maid while we were talking. And he came up and kissed me on the cheek. And she kept him there for the rest of the interview. But she went into all of the details and told me she was right there in the stand with two grandchildren. She might have been about the second row. There were about three or four rows of people in the reviewing stand with the president. Nevertheless, her maid was with her and shoved her down onto her, not only the hands and knees, but put her down flat on the platform immediately at the first shot. And threw herself on her own body on top of Mrs. Sadat and the grandchildren to protect them. And they were spared. Mrs. Sadat is half English and half Arab. But she seems to be more English than Arab. She's not like an Arab. She is a most unusual woman. I've met many of the head women of the world. I had a long talk with Golda Meir when she was Prime Minister of Israel, also with Indira Gandhi, the Prime Minister of India, the second largest country in the world, also a long talk in her own home with Mrs. Vandranaike, who was the Prime Minister of Sri Lanka. And I know, of course, I know Mrs. Marcos, the First Lady of the Philippines. And besides Princess Lillian, the wife of King Leopold, also Princess Grace of Monaco, who sat next to me at a banquet one time where I was co-host, and her husband sat across from me. And the custom in Europe and the Middle East and the East is the host and the second man will always sit in the middle of the table across from each other, not at the end of the table. So Prince Rainier and I were the co-hosts, and he sat opposite me, but his wife, Princess Grace, sat on my left. And I had quite a conversation with her. She's a very charming lady, by the way, and a very accomplished... She may have been a movie star, but she came from a very fine family, I understand, and is quite an accomplished woman. So I have known some of those women, and I think that a meeting is being planned for me to have a meeting either on my next trip, late January or February, or at least next summer, with the Prime Minister of England, Mrs. Thatcher. And it just occurred to me that perhaps I should write a book on the women that are heading governments in the world these days. You know what Isaiah says in the third chapter, that in these last days that women would be our rulers. And indeed, they're becoming that. Don't be surprised if we have a woman president next. Because Teddy Kennedy's already made a try at it and he missed out. Maybe some woman will beat him to it next time. Mr. Reagan said he's only running for one term, that he intended to be a one-term president. At least he made that statement during the campaign before he was elected. I don't know what he'll decide now. If his popularity is still good, that's going to be quite a temptation to run again. Well, after we left Cairo, we flew on to Geneva, had to have a conference with our office there and our manager, and we were there overnight. And then on the way to London early in the morning, and I had to be up from 3 o'clock in the morning on to make all of the connection, we stopped off in Munich, where I decided that I would like to have another talk with the strong man of Europe, Franz Josef Strauss. He has wanted to be the Chancellor of West Germany and has never made it. He was a guest in my home here 10 years ago. At dinner that evening, he had spoken, I believe he spoke to our students during the day, and he was all over the campus, and had dinner in my home that evening with his wife and his bodyguard, who was along with him. He carried an armed bodyguard everywhere he went. And I had talked with him in the library of my home. I knew that he wanted so much to be chancellor. I said, Dr. Strauss, you, in my judgment, are not going to be chancellor of West Germany, but